Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, actually, it's not clear if it will be on Monday. German officials said that it's going to be on Monday no matter what, but there are no details. I could not find any details on what's going to happen and how it's going to happen and from which places.
That's reporter Mariama Karakoulaki in Greece commenting on plans to begin returning migrants to Turkey on Monday. Also, the mayors of Brussels and Paris met to discuss the roots of ethnic tensions in their cities that may have led to the terror attacks. The IMF lowers its economic forecast for Nigeria, and a new study finds that the risk for intestinal parasitic infection is highest for many people in rapidly growing urban areas of low-income countries. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, there have been grim and tragic discoveries at the Ngong dump site, one of the largest landfills in Kenya. Newborn babies are often found there among the trash. Many of the infants are found alive and put up for adoption, but not all. Rael Ambor reports from Ngong.
Shadrack Musyoka has been sorting garbage at the Ngong dump site for 20 years. He keeps a log of how many containers he fills for sale to recycling companies, but since 2013, he has also kept another list. 60 newborn babies, it reads, were found in the trash in 2015, up from the 12 he recorded in 2013. He says one morning he came to work early, and a teacher walking by heard a baby cry. She listened carefully and found a box with a baby inside. She was in a hurry, so she handed over the baby to him. He says they went to the police and called a local children's home, and the baby was taken to hospital for a medical examination. "We are poor," he says. "We cannot take care of such a child." The 10-acre dump takes in garbage from all over Nairobi. He says it's nearly impossible to track where the babies come from or pinpoint which garbage truck the infant came in on. Musyoka says the incidents are due to carelessness and poor parenting. He says a family must have a strong foundation and raise its girls well. The mother, he says, plays a very important role. But others say men also should shoulder responsibility. Jacqueline Mudoni was gang-raped as a teenager in 2002. She says she contemplated throwing the baby away because she could not deal with the stigma. She says the first thing that happens when you get pregnant without planning is that you hate yourself, especially if you're raped like she was. She says she didn't know whose baby it was. She kept seeing the different faces of these men. And she says she felt like she was carrying a dog. Sometimes garbage. Mudhani ultimately gave up her baby for adoption. Mama Zipora founded the Huruma Children's Home in Ngong. She takes in some of the babies found at the nearby dump site. She says those babies are too young to remember how they were abandoned.
After 6 months, after nobody comes to claim them, we get a letter from the police and we contact the adoption society to find homes for them. They are in their homes now with parents who are caring for them.
But not all babies are so lucky. In the 2015 annual crime report, Kenya's Inspector General of Police reported a 55% increase in infanticide cases. Based on complaints filed at police stations, the offense carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. It is unclear what is driving that spike, but experts say one possible solution is to help women avoid unwanted pregnancies. Kenyan public hospitals now offer free reproductive health services. These include free consultations on family planning and distribution of contraceptives such as condoms. But non-governmental organizations working with youth say that it is not enough. Patrick Owuko is the founder of Seed Foundation. He says the teenagers he works with know about condoms but choose not to use them.
When youth are adolescents, they want to experiment with their bodies and their bodies are changing. So it ends up maybe going maybe in a way that they might not have expected.
Back at the dumping site, Musioka sorts out garbage and says he hopes a solution can be found. Until then, he will keep looking out for infants in need of saving. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Ngong, Kenya.
Well, Monday is the scheduled starting date to return migrants and refugees from the Greek islands to Turkey. It's part of the recently signed deal between the European Union and Turkey. Under the agreement, for every migrant that Turkey takes back from Europe, the EU will resettle another. Most of those that have arrived in Europe have traveled from Turkey across the Aegean Sea to Greece. Those who arrived after the deal was finalized 2 weeks ago are being detained and will be returned. However, it's not clear how smoothly the plan will work. Reporter Mariama Karakoulaki is following developments from the Greek city of Thessaloniki. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Well, actually, it's not clear if it will be on Monday. German officials said that it's going to be on Monday no matter what, but there are no details. I could not find any details on what's going to happen and how it's going to happen and from which places people are going to return back to Turkey. Right now there are around 5,300 detainees in the island, in the hotspots in Lesbos, Chios and Samos. Some people say that 300 people are going to return, others say 500, but the details are not known yet.
Is it surprising that the details are not known, considering that we've been hearing this week that the plan would be implemented Monday?
No, it's not surprising. First of all, Greece is not prepared for the implementation of the EU-Turkey deal, Greece or the European Union or Turkey. Secondly, even if they were prepared, I don't think they want any media attention because it's going to cause some probably demonstrations by activists and volunteers in the islands and even the migrants. So I think they try to keep it as silent as it can be.
What about the 50,000 or so migrants and refugees on the mainland in Greece? What's happening with them?
Well, in theory, they can apply for asylum in Greece and for the EU relocation program. So their cases are going to be examined individually. I doubt that they will be sent back to Turkey, but it's going to take a lot of time for them to be either relocated or to take asylum in Greece.
What is the latest on Idomeni, on the Greek-Macedonian border? We've been following that story, as you know, about the thousands of people on the border, somehow hoping that that border will eventually reopen. What are you hearing today?
Well, the border is not going to open. This has been quite clear for quite a long time now. The latest is that the Minister of Civil and Protection, Mr. Toskas, announced that Idomeni is going to be empty in 3 weeks, but he didn't say if it's going to be evacuated by force, like it happened the previous times, or the authorities are going to try to convince refugees to go to the hotspots around Greece and to apply for asylum or for relocation. What he did say, though, is that in specific cases, force might be used. So there's no clear plan yet, but this is the latest announcement.
Mariana, what is the mood like in Greece with all the migrants and refugees there? How do the Greeks feel about them?
The feelings are mixed. However, I can see that people are very compassionate to refugees and they feel empathy towards refugees. Greeks have been refugees themselves and they have been migrants all over Europe and the US and Australia, for example. There are loads of independent volunteers. People are giving out everything that they can and many people have started hosting families in their houses.
That's Mariama Karakoulaki from the Greek city of Thessaloniki. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. And in related news, Amnesty International reports that Turkey may be illegally rounding up Syrian refugees at the border and returning them to Syria. It says as many as 100 have been returned every day since January. Oh. As Libya migration traffic heats up again, the mayors of Brussels and Paris have met to discuss the roots of ethnic tensions in their cities that may have led to terror attacks. Brussels, for example, has experienced unrest in its Moroccan and Turkish enclaves. From Brussels, reporter Esther Judah talked to VOA's David Arnold about the mayor's meeting and ethnic tensions in Belgium.
The mayor of Brussels, Mayer, met with socialist mayor Hildego in Brussels in the aftermath of the attack. They met to speak on the security issues and the issue of radicalization in both of the cities, but mainly also to express a kind of unified solidarity over the victims of the most recent attacks in Brussels, but also, of course, of the attacks in November, which hit the city of Paris and obviously killed many Belgian citizens too. It was a very symbolic meeting as opposed to perhaps a content-worthy meeting. However, obviously the cities have not only been affected by the issue of terrorism, but are also the origins, I would say, of a radical Islamic extremism, something that's affected the commune of Molenbeek and other areas in Brussels, such as Saint-Josse, another majority, in this case, Turkish area, and Skarbek, another area where raids took place in the aftermath of the attacks, which is similar, I would say, in some perspective, but also very different from the periphery of Paris, which is where one of the arrests took place in the aftermath of the Paris attack.
Where do many of the foreign populations come from who now live in Greater Brussels?
Well, specifically in Brussels, there's a very, very strong Moroccan population. I have to say there is also a very similar Sunni Muslim population from Turkey. However, very interestingly, we see that the majority, and I would say far beyond the majority, of those who've left to become foreign fighters in Syria are of Moroccan origin. The latest statistics from King's College London Department of War Studies is giving a statistic of 80% of those who've left for jihad are coming specifically from this Moroccan community. And another 10% are coming from or are converts, which leaves just another 10% left of those from other backgrounds.
Does it have anything to do with the possibility that many of these communities are underserved populations which become a seedbed for jihad?
Well, of course, many of these tend to come from underserved, underprivileged backgrounds, of coming from areas with high youth unemployment and social housing issues. However, I have to say that it would seem to suggest that there's something specifically within the Turkish community. It does not have a high, or the Turkish community, which is very present in Brussels, it does not at all give a high percentage of foreign fighters, yet they also struggle from the same issues of structural racism or structural or unemployment, and specifically youth unemployment. So it would seem that although these social and economic explanations are incredibly important in understanding why these populations are feeling alienated and ostracized, it doesn't quite explain it 100%.
And what is the geographic comparison of Paris to Brussels? And
geographically, there's a very important difference in between the two cities. In Paris, is that the socio-economic issues are more on the periphery of the city. But in Brussels or in Belgium, that argument is slightly more flawed. Molenbeek is a 10-minute walk, maybe 15-minute walk at best from the center of town. It's not at all cut off, and if anything, it's not at all as comparable in terms of the socio-economic depravities.
Is there anything that the mayor or the government have been doing in recent years to create employment, improve housing in some of these areas?
Well, most definitely. This is something that has been identified as a problem many years before. In fact, there was a very well-known meeting that took place in 2013 where the federal government invited mayors from all over the country to meet and to discuss this issue. However, speaking to specifically the deputy mayor, El Khanous, of Molenbeek, the way that he describes the final conclusions of this security strategic meeting, if they want to go, let them go. This is an exporting of our issues out to Syria. So why deal with it when it's easier if our problems just fly out on one-way tickets to Turkey on their way to Syria? In the aftermath of the Brussels attacks, what we're seeing is that the problems are now returning. There will be a form of soul-searching in these communities or in these city halls.
Is there a public conversation now?
Since the attacks in Brussels, the city is still in a very much a state of shock. Also mourning. I think we haven't quite got there yet.
That's reporter Esther Judah in Brussels. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Well, of all the European countries, France has by far the largest percentage of people who were born in Africa or who are descended from those who were. The majority of France's African diaspora lives in Paris. Earlier this week, Patrick Klugman, Paris deputy mayor, spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Klugman began by saying that he was proud of the cultural diversity Africans bring to the City of Lights, but he is mindful of the challenges they face.
I often say that we are the most non-African African city because we have a lot of Africans living in Paris, from Senegal, from Ivory Coast, from Congo, from Mali, totally part of the Parisian life and the history of Paris.
Yes and no.
Yes and no, but they go back and forth with Africa, and this is very natural. And our links are very strong, very powerful.
Could you tell me a little bit about the themes of inclusion and equality as it relates to the African diaspora population within Paris? Because I know they're not really mainstreamed in the same way.
It's a real challenge because you have always a risk that people stay together, do not match, do not mix. And of course, it exists among African communities as well as other communities. And now we are doing a lot, really to match people. For instance, at Paris, we are supporting projects in Africa driven by communities in Paris, in their countries of origin. And this is to strengthen the links between diaspora and Africa, Paris, and the cities in Africa that we know, and it works pretty well.
Can you draw a distinction between your policy or your approach, shall we say, between the North African population of the Arab base, the former colonies, if you like, and the sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, we have the two populations in Paris. They're very different, obviously, but we deal with them the same way. We want that they themselves to be at their ease in Paris, to be part of the Parisian life, to mix with other people from other origins. Diversity is a great chance, opportunity for Paris. You know that Africa is probably the land for the highest growth in the coming years and decades. And for us, it's a chance to have all this population living in Paris, making business from Paris. Of course, there are problems. Of course, sometimes I would say French look at them very strangely and not sympathetically. But we are very keen on putting people together. Mm-hmm. And African people, North African, they have their place in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's not a worry for us. Like in New York, I mean, if you don't have room or place for these people in your city, you're not a globalized city.
That was the deputy mayor of Paris, Patrick Klugman. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Nigeria has received some bad economic news. The International Monetary Fund is downgrading its economic growth forecast for the country to 2.3% this year. That's down from 2.7% last year. The IMF says low crude oil prices are creating substantial challenges for Nigeria. Reuters reports the IMF also cites lower non-oil revenues, financial problems for state and local governments, and disruptions in the private sector due to limited access to foreign exchange. It adds that the ongoing violence in the north from the Boko Haram insurgency also plays a role. A new study finds that the risk for intestinal parasitic infection is highest for people in rapidly growing urban areas of low-income countries that lack safe management of wastewater. In particular, contact with human and animal fecal matter causes infections such as hookworms and intestinal protozoa. The study was conducted by researchers from the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute and their colleagues in Uganda. They examined the prevalence and risk factors for intestinal parasitic infections in the growing suburbs of Kampala, where only a small proportion of wastewater is treated. The vast majority is discharged without treatment into open stormwater channels, jeopardizing the health of people who come into contact with it. Dr. Samuel Furiman is lead author of the study. He says the findings call for increased public health protection measures for urban farmers and marginalized groups. The study also found that wastewater can be successfully recycled to boost food production.
The study was conducted within the framework of a resource recovery and reuse project with a clear focus on urban centers in low and middle income countries. There we had one major resource, which was wastewater, and this generates a lot of livelihood when it's reused, especially in the urban settings. The high nutrient load and the all year around availability has a lot of gains for agriculture and aquaculture in these settings.
The study used a cross-sectional survey between five groups of populations, totaling about 950 people who would likely be at risk of contact with polluted water. They include workers at wastewater facilities, workers collecting fecal sludge from pits using vacuum trucks, urban farmers, and slum dwellers. The study examined one stool sample per person. Furman says the results raise important issues concerning the proper treatment of fecal waste.
As urbanization continues at a rapid pace, this poses especially challenges for the safe management of wastewater and also fecal sludge, which is actually collected from pit latrines. For example, Kampala has about 90% of the people rely on that. Hence, this is quite a challenge to safely manage.
Dr. Furman says the goal now is to reduce the health risk of these people, especially urban farmers who showed the highest risk for intestinal parasites from exposure to waste.
For example, the sanitation workers, which were daily exposed, had actually the lowest risk and also the lowest prevalences of all worm infections. But at the same time, we found that urban farmers had about 76% of them were infected with intestinal parasites. So this is what we normally expect in a rural setting and not in an urban setting where we have all the medical health care available. And especially for hookworms and Schistosoma manzanae, which can both penetrate the skin. And you could also determine that the level of education is one of the major factors which is linked to this infection.
Dr. Furman stressed that it is vital for urban farmers and others who might be exposed to waste matter to protect themselves on a daily basis from exposure to human and animal waste. This includes wearing protective clothing and other measures.
The washing of all this equipment is very important. So many of the people there, they actually wash the equipment directly with wastewater, which of course recontaminates the equipment again. Then the second thing would be the personal hygiene. So hand washing after the work is very important. And the use of toilet facility. So there's a lot of open defecation still happening. And last, there is also the regular deworming, which is not happening. So we would recommend that farmers would deworm themselves every 2 to 3 months.
Dr. Furman emphasizes that all stakeholders should become actively engaged in educating people about the importance of personal hygiene and implementing procedures and guidelines to ensure the proper disposal of waste. He adds that policymakers should explore the causes of water contamination, for example, through toilets or the illegal discharge of fecal matter. They should also determine the impact of improper waste disposal on children, who are at the highest risk of contamination and infection by parasitic worms. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.